Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 267 for June 27th, 2010. Coming up in a few minutes.
You know, in most of the colonies, the native grain was rye, and so rye whiskey sprung up, and it was the ubiquitous spirit of consumption during the early years of the founding of the U.S.
That's Dave Pickerel, the former master distiller at Maker's Mark. He's switched from bourbon to rye and is behind the new Whistle Pig Rye Whiskey. More with Dave in a few minutes, including the origin of the Whistle Pig name. First, though, let's look at the news brought to you by Glenmorangie. Dave was instrumental in the restoration of George Washington's distillery at Mount Vernon, just outside Washington, D.C., and distilled some rye spirit 3 years ago using Washington's original recipe. That whiskey will now go on sale Thursday at Mount Vernon. Just 550 bottles of the first batch will be available, with the proceeds to be used for the upkeep of the Mount Vernon estate. I'll be at the distillery Thursday. More on the next episode of Whiskey Cast. Of course, Washington's attitude on taxes led to the Whiskey Rebellion during his presidency, but Scotland's whiskey industry is welcoming the latest move by the UK's coalition government. Chancellor of the Exchequer George Osborne has frozen excise taxes on alcohol while the government reviews the entire excise tax system. It's the first time since 2001 that alcohol taxes have been frozen in the government's budget. However, value-added tax is scheduled to rise from 17.5% to 20% in January. The Scotch Whiskey Association is hoping that that excise tax review will lead to all alcoholic drinks being taxed at the same rate by alcohol content. It claims whiskey is taxed at 37% more than beer and 19% more than wine by alcohol content. Bonhams held its first whiskey auction in New York this past week, and Vintage McAllen's dominated the bidding, as usual. High bids included a 50-year-old McAllen that went for $9,520. A 52-year-old McAllen from 1946 went for $4,165. A bottle of Gold Beaumont was the highest-selling non-McAllen, the bid $5,653. Now, those are the high prices, but I need to point out that many lots went for well under retail price. For instance, a lot with 12 bottles of Ardbeg Ugadal went for $893. That comes out to $74 a bottle. And a lot with just 3 bottles, 2 Brewers from 1972 and 1981, and a 1978 20-year-old Dallas Dew went for $327. It's a safe bet you'd pay at least that much for any one of those 3 at retail. By the way, someone paid $655 for 7 bottles of the legendary Loch Dew Black Whiskey from Manicmore, and I used the term legendary loosely. I wasn't doing tasting notes the one time I tasted it several years ago, but it was easily the worst whiskey I've ever tasted. More new whiskeys to talk about this week. A new 25-year-old Kalila will soon be available in many markets. This one is different from the special release 25-year-old Kalila that was bottled at Cask Strength. This version is bottled at 43% ABV. Erin will be celebrating its 15th anniversary with an open day at the distillery this Saturday, and is also releasing a special 1999 vintage finished in an Amontillado sherry cask that will be available in the UK, the US, and 13 other key markets around the world. There is also a bottling of 3 1995 Erin casks that will only be available at the distillery. Chivas Brothers is releasing a new version of Royal Salute. The 62-gun salute will be available in Asian markets starting in January of 2011. The name comes from the traditional 62-gun salute used to mark the anniversary of Queen Elizabeth's coronation each year at the Tower of London. The whiskies used in the 62-gun salute are all at least 40 years old. Pricing has not been announced. Expect it to be expensive. Asian duty-free stores will also get a newly repackaged line of Ballantine's 17, 21, and 30-year-old blended scotches. Finally, the Glenrothes Alba Reserve isn't new, but its status as the only kosher-certified Glenrothes expression is increasing demand. In the U.S., it's only been available until now in New York, New Jersey, and Massachusetts, but distribution is being expanded to include Illinois, California, Rhode Island, and Wyoming. And that's the news, brought to you by Glenmorangie, handcrafted by the 16 men of Tain since 1843. Still a couple of days left to enter the drawing for a bottle of the Glenlivet Founders Reserve. Just email your name, address, and age to the Glenlivet, one word, at whiskeycast.com by midnight New York time, Wednesday, June 30th. I'll announce the winner on the next episode of WhiskeyCast. Let's check the emails of the week now, brought to you by Oban. Sam Macklin in Pittsburgh emailed to ask about pairing whiskey and food. He wrote, "There are some whiskeys I want to enjoy just as a drink, but I'd like to start pairing them. What whiskeys would you have with a meal and why? Keep up the good work." Sam, this is a tricky one for me to answer because I don't often drink whiskey at mealtime. We do cook with it at home, though. My wife used some bourbon to marinate the brisket we grilled last Sunday for Father's Day, as an example. Following that lead, I do like bourbon with grilled meats, and I think peated scotches work really well with salmon and many other seafood dishes. In last week's episode, you might remember the Glenfiddich luncheon at the Mandarin Oriental Hotel in New York City. There, the chefs prepared dishes matched to various Glenfiddich expressions. The dessert was a black cherry almond tart with chocolate cream and toasted pistachio, and it was paired with a Glenfiddich 40-year-old malt. Now, I'm not going to suggest you try that at home, since the 40-year-old is $2,800 a bottle, but you can find a whiskey with similar tasting notes and try that instead. The key, Sam, is experimenting to figure out just what you like. Thanks for the email. If you have a question or suggestion, my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. You can also post questions on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page or by Twitter. Just send your tweets to @WhiskeyCast. The emails of the week are brought to you by Oban Single Malt Whiskey from the coastal town of Oban since 1794. Let's check the calendar of events, brought to you as always by Laphroaig. First off, a correction from the last episode. Whiskey Live Sydney's dates have been changed. I had said last time around it was the first weekend in September, but Eugene Neo emailed me to let me know that it's been moved up a week to avoid a conflict with Father's Day down under. It'll be August 27th and 28th, and thanks, Eugene. The Whiskey Shop Dufton in the heart of Speyside will hold a Gordon & McPhail tasting on July 2nd. As I mentioned earlier, Arran Distillery's annual open day is this coming Saturday in La Crenza, Scotland. Tales of the Cocktail will be July 15th through the 21st in New Orleans. There'll be a tasting of the Glenlivet at Ruth's Chris Steakhouse in Orlando, Florida, July 22nd. Louisville's Filson Historical Society will hold a Filson Friday seminar on Kentucky's historical distillers on July 30th. And Whiskey Fringe in Edinburgh, Scotland is set for August 14th and 15th. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Just click on the Laphroaig banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla. The last time I saw Dave Pickerel was in April of 2008 at the Maker's Mark Thoroughbreds and Redheads weekend in Kentucky. The day after I got back, Dave left Maker's Mark. It came as a complete surprise. Dave kept a low profile for a while after that, but when we talked this week about his new Whistle Pig Rye Whiskey, turns out he was just doing research all that time.
One area has been researching rye, and the other has been researching microdistilleries. And the concept on the micro distilleries is just to figure out where I might plug in, how I might be of assistance in helping get new micro distilleries off the ground. And with rye, I was just fascinated with the concept of rye, and I've really basically talked to pretty much everybody that makes rye in the world and tasted all the samples of it. And when I found the one that is ours, I decided, you know, this one has to come to market, and pretty much dropped everything and started looking for a partner that would help me be able to bring it to market.
How much of this came out of your work at George Washington's distillery? Because that may be the ultimate micro distillery, and it was producing rye back 200 plus years ago.
You know, Mark, I really hadn't thought about that, but that's probably the genesis of all of it. Because I did spend quite a bit of time working with George Washington Distillery. And in fact, it's my understanding that they're going, you know, a couple of years ago I made the first commercial batch of George Washington's rye that's been made in 200 years. And they're going to actually, I think July 1st is when it goes on sale at George Washington's store in Mount Vernon. And but in fact, that may in fact be the genesis of all of this. Both the passion for the micro distiller as well as the passion for the rye, because I spent so much time on the wonderful history of behind the concept of rye.
Let's go into some of that history, because it really was the first American whiskey, right?
It was. You know, it was the Green Mountain Boys whiskey, if you will. It was just kind of fun because, you know, Whistle Pig Rye, the Whistle Pig Farm Distillers in the Green Mountain. But it was a Patriots whiskey. During the Revolution, you know, it wasn't just tea that the Americans cast off. They also got rid of rum, because rum was associated with the British and the British trade and everything. And so when they were casting off rum as their distilled spirit, then they began to look inward. And in most of the colonies, the native grain was rye. So rye whiskey sprung up, and it was the ubiquitous spirit of consumption during the early years of the founding of the U.S. And in fact, one of the things that's fun for me is, you know, when you think of a lot of these traditional American cocktails, you know, the truth is the first mint julep that was ever made almost undoubtedly was made with rye whiskey. As was probably the first Old Fashioned, the first Sazerac, and most of the cocktails were probably originally made with rye whiskey.
How much fun was it to go from working with a large-scale distillery like Maker's Mark to working with all these little micro distilleries?
Oh, it's absolutely a joy for me. You know, I'm pretty ADD, and having a lot of things on the plate at once is really grand. The caliber of people that I'm working with is just phenomenal. They're all excited. They're on the front and the cutting edge of a new trend, and they're all experimental. So, you know, everybody is out there looking to find a niche, to create something new and interesting and exciting, and they all want quality and respect in the market. So it's a fun experience to be associated with such a great crowd of people like that.
How much of your experience from the large-scale distilleries can translate down to these guys? Because when you were at Maker's, you were used to making huge batches of whiskey at one time, and now it's down to the point where these guys are filling up one small still at a time and running it through a couple of times.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because the chemistry behind it, the chemistry, the biology, the engineering behind the processes doesn't really change. The principles are all the same. It's just the application of the principles that differs. And one of the fun things for me has been, you know, one of my specialties is distillation system design, and coming up with new and novel approaches that people hadn't thought about for controlling column and kettle stills, to come up with the right proof at the right time. It's really fun. As a matter of fact, one of the things that was amusing to me the other day, we were playing around with a column and kettle still, and the guys that owned it told me, well, we can't get it. It had four trays on it. The guys told me, well, I can't get anything higher than about 110 proof off of it. And if I'm trying to make a spirit run on this thing, I'd really like to, you know, get it up to, you know, 140, 150 on the second pass, and then run a third pass to run it on up. And I'm going, come on, guys, we can do better than that. And they're going, no, that's all this thing will do. And so I did a little tweaking here, a little tweaking there, readjusted a couple things, and changed the reflux ratio rather substantially. And in a single pass, we went from 8% alcohol in the pot to 180 proof for the entire spirit, for the entire first run.
Interesting.
And they were just astounded that, you know, that's one of the fun things is you can do anything you want. And so I have a lot of fun with folks just, you know, tell me what you want. You know, we can make it work. You know, we've got so much flexibility, especially with the new column and kettle still designs that are out there right now. And you know, I've done a fair amount of work with Vendome copper and brass, and there's a, they've got a great, really hyper-flexible column and kettle design that allows so much flexibility in what you do that it's just unbelievable the different qualities and types and styles of spirit you can run off of the thing.
Now, you've made reference to column and kettle stills. Okay, Dave, you've made reference to column and kettle stills a couple of times here. For those who are not expert on distilling or haven't been to a distillery, explain what the difference is between a column and kettle still and the common copper pot still that we're used to seeing in a distillery.
Sure. In a traditional distillery, you'll see that typically they have what's called a beer still. And a beer still is just a big cylinder that's got flat plates in it, and it's probably, 34 to 40 feet tall, and it probably has at least 16 trays in it, and you enter the it's a continuous operation. So you put a feed stream in, probably like three quarters of the way up, and the bottom part of it's referred to as the tripping section, and that's taking getting the alcohol from 8% down to about zero, and then the top section of it is the rectifying section, and that's the section where you ratchet up the proof so that you can come off at whatever you want, typically 120 to 160 if you're bourbon, and it requires a few trays, but then they'll condense that, put it in back into a pot still, which is just your garden variety pot still, and then redistill it a second time for clearing up and everything. But with the micro distillers, there's a different kind of still called a column and kettle. And if you can imagine starting with a pot, and then you just screw the top four trays of a column on top of it, where the alembic would have been, and what you get is that it's a batch process, but the pot acts as the equivalent and the replacement for the bottom two-thirds of a column still. And it does all the stripping is done right there at the pot. And then so all you need is the four trays on top of it for rectifying. And so by clever adjustment of your flow rates and the amount of reflux you had back to the still, you can control the everything from the congener levels to the proof of the distillate that comes off.
And you said you can do this at a much lower cost than a conventional column still setup. Tell me what we're talking about if somebody wanted to set up a distillery with one of these things.
Well, just for equipment, for instance, my gut is that if you wanted a 250-gallon column and kettle still system, with a boiler, cooling tower, chiller, all in, just all the equipment costs, you're probably well below $250,000 now, or somewhere in the vicinity of $250,000, which is unheard of. A few years ago, a system like that would have been closer to $1 million than to $250,000. But there's been a lot of refinements that have taken place in bringing the cost of these things down. By getting a little bit more exotic with the control systems, and by being a little bit more efficient with the use of the copper, I think of it as pre-engineering. If you're building a building, if you're just building a one-off building, you get a cost. But if you're going to build a dozen just like it, it's worth spending the engineering time to cut the fat out, and you can substantially reduce the cost per building to do it. Well, it's kind of the same thing. What Vendome has done, I refer to it as a distiller in a box. Instead of saying, somebody comes in and says, I want a 100-gallon still, and then they say, great, and they do a custom design. And then the next guy comes in and says, I want a 105-gallon still, and they do a custom design. Well, instead of doing that, we just say, no. There's a 125, a 250, a 750, 500, and for the little itty-bitty guys, a 30-gallon. And we just steer everybody towards one of those common sizes, and that way we can cut all the fat out of the design and substantially reduce the price tag for all the equipment.
So you were talking $250,000 for for a 250-gallon setup. What's the cost for a little 30-gallon?
Oh gosh, for a little 30-gallon, I can't really remember the price tag on that, but it's not much. They're surprisingly little.
It's the kind of thing an ultra micro distiller could set up fairly easily.
Oh, yeah, that meant something you could put on a bar. I mean, that's how small it is. And the reason for the 30-gallon is it's the largest system that you can run with electricity. You can actually heat the still with electricity. And so it's a really cool little system. It's really beautiful. But it's kind of fun.
I think that goes without saying, Dave.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, you know, life is fun for me. I'm enjoying this. But you know, and in particular, I'm enjoying the Whistle Pig product. You know, this is launch week for Whistle Pig.
And I was about to get to that. Let's talk about Whistle Pig. How did you get involved with these guys?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, these guys is really me and the partner Raj Vakta. And then our PR marketing is done with Yuri Kato, and together we are a great team of folks, because each of us runs in our own direction. Raj is really, really awesome with the entrepreneurship and the business and the finance and the out of the box thinking on marketing ideas. Yuri is really great at the execution on the PR, marketing, sales stuff, and you know, my niche obviously is in the juice itself. So you put the three of us together, and we've got one heck of a good team. On top of it, we've got an incredible product. You know, the thing about Whistle Pig rye, it's really nice, is it's 10-year-old, and it's 100% rye. And to my knowledge, I think it's the only aged 100% rye that you can really get right now. You know, the reason for 100% rye is because rye is such an incredible spirit in terms of its taste profile that by making it 100% rye, you don't complicate it. You know, you allow the spiciness of the rye to stand out on its own. I tell people when you taste it, it's like having a fireworks display in your mouth. And what I mean by that is you can just sit back and just enjoy the whole display all at once, and the immensity of it, and the intensity, and all like that. But if you want, you can enjoy the individual firework. You can say, oh, I like that one with the heart, or I like that the chrysanthemum, or I like the big boomer, or whatever. Well, and that's the same thing with Whistle Pig. You know, you can enjoy the whole panorama of the spices, or you can say, oh, look, there goes the anise, and there goes the clove, and there goes the allspice, and there's the ginger, and the mint, and the bergamot. You can actually pick them out individually. So because it's 100% rye, it's just marvelous on the front end for the wonderful spicy aroma and array of taste. But because it's 10 years old, you've got a marvelous balance between the wood and the grain, so that instead of getting that traditional rye kick in the pants for a finish, it lays over and plays nice, and you get this warm, long, butterscotch vanilla caramel finish that's really surprising to people, because they expect to get kicked. And it doesn't happen with Whistle Pig.
So how did you get from, if I can ask Dave, how did you get from being with these guys for just a couple of years to having a 10-year-old whiskey?
Well, it is a found product. It was a part of my 18 months of research is running around the world. And I honestly think that I've talked to every reasonably large producer of rye whiskey in the world and tasted most of the products. And found this basically laying around in a warehouse unused. And when I first tasted it, you know, I wasn't done with my research yet. But I remember when I first tasted it, I thought, oh my goodness, I have to get this to market. So I finished my research just in case there was something better out there. But I really didn't think there would be, and then in fact there wasn't. And once I found it, you know, I got my sample bottles of it, and then it's just, I need a partner that can help me bring this to market. And that's where Raj comes in. And the amazing thing in all this is literally Raj and I were introduced by Vendome December 8th of last year. We met at the farm on December 19th, and the purpose of the meeting wasn't a business meeting. It was just, can we be friends? Because, you know, to me, you know me, that's, you know, relationship is everything.
Right.
And, you know, if we can't be friends, we certainly can't be business partners. And so literally, we just hung out for 3 days and just had fun. And at the end of the 3 days, we said, we can do this. And we shook hands. And from December, and that was December 19th. And from there to now is all it took for us to get this to market. So that's incredibly fast. I mean, which just speaks volumes to how great of an entrepreneur Raj is, and how good he is at putting all the pieces and parts of the financing and the and it's even we've got a custom bottle and getting all the licensure in place and everything. It's just amazing how quickly this came together.
And this really is going to differ from other micro distillers in that it is 10 years old. And one of the things I've noticed sampling a lot of micro distiller product is that a lot of these folks are releasing it a little too early, in my opinion.
Well, you know, there's a major problem with cash flow. You know, most micro guys start out undercapitalized, and they really need to do something to get cash flow right. And, you know, and there's all kinds of things you see. You know, some of them say, hey, we're going to make vodka. But there's problems with making vodka, and you have to have a marketing advantage. Even if you make the best stuff in the world, you still have to have a marketing niche because that playing field is so cluttered. And some of them say, well, we'll sell white whiskey, and I think that's probably a better answer for most people because the white whiskey category is getting some legs on it, but it's a small volume still. And recently, some of them have been able to say, well, we'll put it away in small barrels, because that small barrel technology is going to help us mature it a little faster and so we can get it to market sooner. You know, Tuttletown obviously has done a marvelous job of educating the consumers about the use of small barrels. And there will be a lot of other guys come along with that thing as well. But once in a while you get somebody that comes out with something that the reality is they got to sell something to get cash flow right, and they know it's not their best stuff, but the hope is that the consumer will endure while they get to their best stuff, which is still going to be a couple of years more in the barrel.
Now, how do you get to the point from the point of sourcing rye whiskey to making the stuff yourself up in Vermont?
Well, good point. We're using the proceeds from this to fund the building of Whistle Pig Rye Distillery, we've already got it designed, laid out, and all that kind of stuff, and starting to move towards the procurement. And the goal is that this fall, we're going to plant organically certified rye on the site, so that next year, when the harvest comes in, we'll be ready to start our first mashing and distilling of 100% rye, and it's going to be an estate rye, which we think is going to be the first estate whiskey in the United States. And so we're really excited about that.
Now, you're a Kentucky boy. How did you wind up in Vermont?
Well, you know, I commute a lot. I pretty much live out of a suitcase anymore. I think in April, I added it up. I think I was home for 2.5 days the whole month of April. I don't even know why I own a house. I ought to just live in a mobile home or something. Or an RV.
Are you going to wind up moving up to Vermont to do this on a day-to-day basis?
I'm not sure. Probably not. What I hope to do is to find a young buck that I can train up, to do the day-to-day stuff, and I'll oversee all the policies and procedures and the design and any oopses and stuff like that. Kind of a lot like that's kind of a niche of mine. You know Kevin Smith, and he's a protege of mine, and he's the master sword makers. And then Denny Potter was another guy that I kind of brought in and trained up, and he's down at Cruisin' Rum right now, and I've got a few devotees that are pupils or whatever that I've trained up over the years that have popped up at various other places, and it's kind of a niche of mine. That's kind of what I'm hoping to do in this case too.
How long will your rye supply hold out until you have your own stuff ready to go?
We're in good shape. I don't want to give a prescribed age statement yet, because we're not going to put it out until it's right. But we've got enough supply on hand, I think, to get us through regardless.
So if there was an existing rye product out there that this compares to, what would it compare to for somebody who's tried other ryes?
Oh wow! You know, I've been asked that so much, and I honestly hate to say this, because it's going to sound trite, but I really don't think there is a good comparison, because about 97% of all the rye out there is either under 6 years and under, or 16 and older, And so if it's 6 and under, it's still a little bit green. And so it's still got a little bit of that green whiskey bite. And if it's 16 and older, it's got a little bit of that tannin bite. And really between 6 and 16 years, there's only two other products, and that's Michter's and Patrick Van Winkle's Family Reserve Rye. And, the Family Reserve Rye is, I think, about 13 years, and it's got its own distinct character, and the Michter's is, I don't think it's anywhere near 100% rye. So I really honestly think there's this 10-year window where there's just not much there, and that's part of the reason why it was so important for us to go to market with this, is because we're filling this great big vacancy.
What states are you going to be in market right now?
We're not even thinking states, because I've only got 1,000 cases for year one. So we're going into New York, San Francisco, and Chicago. And hopefully, and we've got some, there's a guy in New York City that's going to take it on and sell it on the web. So some folks will be able to pick it up off the web if they want to as well.
And I would imagine there's a few stores that also do mail order that can also ship it.
Yes. Yeah.
We're talking folks like Park Avenue and places like that.
If you get on our website, the Whistlepig website, you can. We'll eventually be able to direct you to folks that are doing online sales too, so that. If you really have a hankering for it and it's just not anywhere near you, you can pick one up online.
And the website address is?
It's whistlepig.com.
Whistlepig.com.
Whistlepigwhiskey.com.
Okay. What's the origin of the name Whistlepig?
My partner, Raj, was out hiking in the Vale, and he's walking along in the mountains, and here comes this French guy with long, flowing gray hair, pedaling a bicycle head fast down the hill. He's just going 90 miles an hour, and all of a sudden he slides to a stop, and he looks at Raj, and he looks over his shoulder and says, could it be a Whistlepig? And Raj looks at him like, what are you talking about? And the guy goes, it was a pig. Could it be a Whistlepig? And Raj goes, I don't understand what you're talking about. And the guy goes, a Whistlepig. And he puts his hand to his mouth and goes, and Raj goes, I don't understand. And the guy goes, and jumps back on his bike and takes off down the mountain. And so Raj goes, this is so strange. I have got to do something with this. So eventually he bought his farm out in Shoreham, Vermont, and named it Whistlepig Farm. And then when he and I met, we just decided, this is just absolutely appropriate for this brand. It's fun. It's memorable. And so Whistlepig Rye it is.
I haven't tried Whistlepig yet, but I'm looking forward to it. I did try several other whiskeys this week, and let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with an interesting idea from the guys at Master of Malt. They're doing a Drinks by the Dram series where they take current and rare bottlings and sell 30-milliliter samples. For instance, a sample of Ardbeg 1975 sells for about $26.60. It is pricey, but that may be the only way you might get to taste one. They sent me a sample of a signatory bottling of 1983 Port Ellen Cask Strength 27-year-old malt at 55.7% ABV. The nose is lightly peated with notes of coconut and vanilla, just a hint of malt. The taste slightly smoky and peaty with sweet honey and coconut notes, and the finish is smoky with sweet undertones, a hint of caramel candy and lemon drops. It gets a 90 in my book. The Chieftain's line of independent bottlings has a new U.S. distributor, but is familiar to many European whiskey lovers. When I was in Speyside last month, we passed by the Alta Bane distillery. Its output goes for blending these days, but Chieftain's has bottled a 31-year-old cask from 1976 at 43% ABV. The nose is light with almonds and nutmeg, just a hint of honey and cinnamon. The taste is a nice combination of cinnamon, vanilla, and honey balanced against a lemony tartness. The finish is sweet and lingering, and I'm giving the Chieftain's Alta Bane 1976 single cask an 85. Now, Sheep Dip is one of those underrated blended malts that lives on the lower shelves at many retailers, but deserves a lot more attention. Richard Patterson blended 16 malts together for Alex Nichols' Spencerfield Spirits Company to create Sheep Dip. The nose is fruity with hints of orange, mango, and banana, with just a touch of honey and almond. The taste is slightly malty with honey, black tea, and lemon, and the finish becomes slightly smoky as the honey notes fade. It's a very smooth dram. I'm giving the Sheep Dip an 88. You'll find all of my tasting notes in the WhiskeyCast iPhone app sponsored by the Glenrothes, as well as the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you'll find links to the WhiskeyCast Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. And my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. I love hearing from you. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2010, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.